I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. He's pioneered the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery, which has led to the development of over 30 companies. He is a father of three children and a magician. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your influence on the biomaterials field is vast, and I'd like to start with the early days of your professional life because, in a way, it helped to inform what you are doing today. After graduating from Cornell, you were a graduate student at MIT, and this was during the 1970s, during the energy crisis. How did the energy crisis indirectly lead you to the field of scientific discovery?
Sure. There was this gas shortage, you know, all over the country, and the gas shortage in Boston was really bad. So there were all kinds of jobs in the petrochemical oil industry for chemical engineers. They were hiring like crazy. Pretty much my colleagues, my friends, that's what they did. They got jobs in the oil industry, and so I thought that's what I should do too. So I went to a lot of interviews, and I got about 20 job offers from different oil companies, actually four from Exxon alone. But I remember one of them in particular, one of the engineers said to me, you know, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by like 0.1%, he said, that would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions of dollars. And I remember flying home to Boston that night thinking to myself, I just don't want to do that. It just seemed to me, you know, that I could there were things that I could do with my life that I thought maybe could help people and would be more important, at least to me. So I started looking for other ideas about what I could do.
Now, you sent some ideas for a chemistry curriculum to various education institutions. How were they received?
One of the things I did when I was a graduate student at MIT is I helped start a school for poor kids and high school, and I got involved in creating new chemistry curricula. And so I remember writing letters, answering different ads to different colleges to be an assistant professor that would be developing new chemistry curriculum. But none of them wrote me back. So the next thing I thought about, since I wasn't doing so well finding good jobs or finding any jobs where I could do chemistry education, I thought about medicine. So I wrote to a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either. But one day, one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, there's this surgeon in Boston named Judah Folkman, and he said sometimes he hires unusual people. He thought very highly of Dr. Folkman. I won't say what he thought about me. But I wrote to Dr. Folkman, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
And it was your research with Dr. Folkman that had a seminal impact on what you're doing today to some degree. What was it specifically that you were working on?
So Dr. Folkman had a theory that if you could stop blood vessels from growing in the body, that might be a new way to stop cancer someday, a new way to treat cancer someday. But it was a theory, and actually a lot of people didn't agree with that theory. And what he asked me to do was to see if I could isolate what would become the first inhibitor of angiogenesis, the first inhibitor of blood vessel growth. So that's how I got started.
If you could stop the growth of blood vessels, you could stop the growth of tumors developing further. Is that correct?
Yeah. The thinking was is that tumors without blood vessels will not go beyond a very tiny size of about 1 mm³. But if the tumor is permeated by blood vessels, then that solves the nutrition problem for them, and they can get much bigger. And then, of course, they can also metastasize or spread through those same blood vessels and set up shop in other parts of the body.
You used an eye of a rabbit to help with your research. What is special about the eye of a rabbit?
Yeah, well, it's big, so it's easy to visualize. So what we thought about was if we could have a plastic, a slow-release polymer, that could take anything that was in cartilage, that's what we were studying, and A, not cause harm to the eye, and B, deliver those molecules for a couple months or more, that might be a way to study how blood vessels would grow or not grow.
You mentioned polymers. These are plastics, essentially.
The polymers we use would be plastics. Polymers could also be rubber and so forth. Polymer is basically a long chain substance.
We're talking about manufactured tissues, polymers. What was the landscape of biomaterials when you were pioneering this field in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most biomaterials people used in the body were largely driven by medical doctors, clinicians. And what they do is they would often go to their house and find an object that would kind of resemble the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. So just to give a few examples, the material in the artificial heart, that was a lady's girdle material because it had a good, you know, good buoyancy or flex life. And the material in a breast implant, that was actually, one of them was actually a mattress stuffing because it was the right squishiness. The material in a what's called a vascular graft, an artificial blood vessel, that was a surgeon going to a clothes store and finding something they could sew well with. And so almost all of the biomaterials in the 70s had origins like that. They were sort of what I'd call off-the-shelf materials. And that may solve some problems, but it also created problems because they weren't optimally designed for the body. For example, if you take the artificial heart, the lady's girdle material, you put it in the body, and sometimes the blood hits the surface of that, and it forms a clot. Mm. And that clot could go to the patient's brain, and they'd get a stroke, and they die. Mm. And obviously, there's been problems with different breast implant materials and other things as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer, who is the chief researcher and founder of the Langer Labs at MIT. He's considered a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. In the 1980s, you founded the Langer Lab at MIT. What was the purpose for this lab?
My goals were to do things that I thought might someday help and improve people's lives by doing things at the interface of chemical engineering and medicine.
How was it received when you went to the administration at MIT and said, you know, I'd like to form this lab just to facilitate this research that I'm doing?
Yeah, well, certainly my early years of doing the research, you know, a number of my senior colleagues didn't think it was very important or didn't think it was very good, and they suggested that I probably should start looking for new jobs.
Why was it? Because your field was so nascent, there weren't a lot of... Why was that?
I think that people's idea of what's important probably has a lot to do with what they're doing themselves. And, you know, and they had different areas in this department, but this didn't fit into any of those. And I think the thinking was if I didn't fit into something that pre-existed, I probably wouldn't get promoted. I probably wouldn't get tenure.
Since your research wasn't well received at MIT, did you ever think of maybe moving to an environment that was more friendly to the type of work you were doing?
Well, I actually think MIT was as friendly as any place. You know, my first 9 grants were turned down, and nobody at MIT were on the sections that turned them down. In fact, MIT was you know, I still think is a great place to be. If you go against the prevailing scientific wisdom anywhere in the world, you're going to run into problems.
So how did you break through that conventional bias?
Well, I don't know if I really ever did. I just kept doing the work that I thought was important, and I started, you know, publishing it. And I think pharmaceutical companies started to notice it, and they said that they were nice enough to say that the work they thought was very important.
What were some examples of early breakthroughs that helped to lend credibility to what you were doing?
So we had published this paper in 1976 in Nature showing that you could deliver molecules of almost any size. So that was probably the breakthrough, or that was maybe the first breakthrough. But people thought trying to get these molecules, big molecules, through a plastic was kind of like you or I walking through a brick wall.
Even though the plastic was porous?
Well, people didn't know that then, and we didn't know that then either. So the challenge would be the following. You could either have something that would be non-porous that you couldn't get through at all, or anything that was porous would be kind of like Swiss cheese, so you could get through it, but then you'd get through it almost instantaneously. Mm. And what we were seeing was that we'd have these tiny little particles, and yet the drugs would come out for over 100 days. So the problem would be, how could that happen? And that just defied what I like to say conventional wisdom.
We talk about your research gaining academic acceptance. What was the first example of the commercialization of one of your findings?
Well, there were a couple, but I think one of the early ones was we designed polymers that could dissolve in a certain special way, and what we call surface erosion, kind of like how bar soap dissolves. And what was done in this particular case is it delivers an anti-cancer drug. It's all done locally, so the cancer drug doesn't go throughout the whole body. It just is given locally to the tumor. And then there was a company originally Nova Pharmaceuticals and later Guilford Pharmaceuticals that licensed it and developed it, and ultimately it led to a product that's still used today actually in treating brain cancer called the Gliadel wafer.
This is one of the earliest examples of the commercialization of one of your discoveries. Since then, roughly 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed your discoveries. Were you surprised by this torrent of commercial applications for what you were doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether I was surprised or not. I wanted people to use it. You know, when you're in academia and you're a professor, I mean, you're training students, which I love to do, and you're making discoveries and findings, which is also what I like to do. But I also want to see what we do get used. I just don't want it to be a scientific paper that just, you know, people read about. I wanted to see what we did have an impact on people's lives. That's why I got involved in the patenting process, and that's why, you know, I wanted to see our things get licensed to companies and ultimately license, you know, create companies ourselves, because if we didn't do that, you know, I find if you're not your own champion, it's very hard to find others who are going to be.
Often there's controversy around tech transfer of universities or academics using their discoveries for commercial ends because it leads to potential conflicts of interest. What was that landscape like for you?
I think MIT, you know, along with Stanford, is probably the top two technology transfer places in the world. And I think their goal is really the same as mine. It's not actually to make money. It's really how can we, you know, maximize the chances of products being developed.
MIT, which was founded in 1861, one of its missions was to provide and support industrialization of America. So MIT had more of a commercial slant to it than perhaps other academic institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think MIT wants to see products created. They want to see things get out to the public.
Incidentally, once a technology or an innovation is discovered and is profitable, it's split in three ways. A third of the profit goes to the department, a third goes to the university, and a third goes to the inventor.
As far as I know, that's the policy that MIT uses, and I think a lot of universities follow something close to that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Langer, a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. We'll hear more from Dr. Langer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs, with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. Dr. Langer has helped to launch close to 30 companies, and he holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed his lab's discoveries. We're talking about the profitability of some of these discoveries, and you turn to the private sector for the funding of some of these companies. Polaris is a venture capital company in Boston that has invested over $200 million in your companies, roughly 20 companies. How did that relationship start?
There was a company that I was starting with a woman named Sherry Oberg, and she was wanted to have a company that would create the new imaging agents, and we'd published a paper actually in Science that lended itself to doing that. She was a Dartmouth graduate in the business school. She knew a guy named Terry McGuire, and she introduced me to him, and it was probably early 90s, and she also asked if he was interested in investing in the company, which he did. So we've had a great relationship. I mean, like you said, they've probably done close to 20 companies that we've been involved in.
What are imaging agents? You said that you developed imaging.
Yeah. So in this case, let's say you were doing an ultrasound. And for certain things, you can use ultrasound and, you know, get a pretty good picture. But for example, if you wanted to see whether you had a heart defect or certain other kinds of vascular abnormality, and you tried to use ultrasound, the contrast isn't good enough. So if you could create an ultrasound contrast agent that was good enough, then you could see things by ultrasound imaging that you wouldn't really be able to see otherwise. And you could certainly see it with much, much greater detail.
So, for instance, if you're pregnant and you go to get an ultrasound, are some of these imaging agents used in seeing the baby in the placenta?
So in the case of looking at a baby, you don't need to do that because I think the contrast is good enough. But if you wanted to look at if you wanted to look at something much smaller, let's say you wanted to look at I'll make this up, the baby's toe or something like that, and you wanted to zoom in on it, it might be very hard to see with a regular picture. The contrast agent might be useful for doing that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there are still hardly any ultrasound agents approved, mm-hmm. The ultrasound contrast agents approved. I expect there will be by this or others, but it's a long road to getting approval for anything.
You mentioned that these have not been approved yet, and a firm like Polaris has been very patient. It's patient capital, understanding that they might not see proceeds for decades.
That's right. I mean, though they've done very well, as far as I know, from what I guess people in business called an IRR standpoint. I mean, I think people in the investment business understand that when you're doing medical work, you don't do it on the sales at the time, you do it on the promise of the company, and that's turned out to work. I mean, an early company that I was an advisor to for many, many years was Genentech, and that came out in the stock market and did fantastic, and they had no products, a lot of promise, but ultimately they did get products, and those products were blockbusters.
Let's talk about the entrepreneurial nature of what you've done. Sure. You're a pioneer in science. You are also a pioneer in tech transfer, in a way, in commercializing a lot of this research. What are some of the hurdles that you've faced entrepreneurially, even outside of, you know, the development of your lab in the early days in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I think the challenges that you run into when you try to do entrepreneurial things, I mean, one is always raising money, but two is, again, some of your colleagues won't think highly of it. You know, Dr. Folkman actually said it very well once. He actually got one of the earliest industrial grants. He got about $23 million from Monsanto for his cancer research in the 1970s. And he was at a dinner and somebody asked him, what are the advantages and disadvantages of getting that kind of money? And he said, well, let me do the disadvantages first. He said, there's a gene that a lot of people have that's not expressed directly. It's expressed indirectly. And he said that gene is called jealousy. And if you're a young faculty member, that's not such a good thing because people can control your future. You know, and then a third thing is anytime you try to create any entity, you're dealing with all kinds of people. I mean, with different personalities. I mean, that's good because they're going to, but somehow they have to come together to create this company. And you have to have good business people and good scientists and good clinical people. And sometimes there might be conflicts. And so you have to try to help on those things.
You've helped to launch close to 30 companies. It's not like you're being Jeff Bezos and you launched one company called Amazon. Here you have sprinkled dozens of companies around in your atmosphere. So how do you think about starting a company? Do you just say, well, here's a great idea and, hey, you CEO with this specific background, you go run with it and I'll advise? You're like a godfather to these companies more than in the trenches every day.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to me, my major mission still is being a professor and teaching and doing research at MIT and training students. But I also want, when we create something, for it to get out to the public. And my students and postdocs, some of them will go into academic positions, some of them want to take their inventions and make a company out of it. And so so if we're fortunate enough to, A, have made an important discovery, and, B, have somebody who wants to run with it, you know, I want to help them do that.
Incidentally, some of the applications for your research have been in fields other than medicine. One example is in the waste industry. Can you describe that?
Well, actually, one of the things that one of our postdocs, Avi Dohm, created was a polymer, but that would help in what's called flocculation.
And what
that means is if, like, you have a swimming pool and you have waste or junk in the swimming pool, you know, it could be leaves or it could be, you know, dirt, anything. A flocculant is something that makes those things come together. So rather than it be over your entire pool, over your entire surface, it comes together and it's very easy to then remove. And so there's something that company licensed called Superflock that's very, very widely used.
What are some other tangible technologies that have come out of your lab that we might know of?
Well, we've created fat substitutes that people have used for foods.
What's an example? Like, well, what product?
Like, for example, Hood no-fat sour cream or yogurts, those use these products. Hmm. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things like that. There's a company we've started called Living Proof, which is in the hair care industry. And also Jennifer Aniston is involved in that as well.
As an investor.
Yes. And so there's products that the company and my students and postdocs and everybody we've and people at the company have created that can prevent frizzy hair, that can give hair more body. And of course, all the medical ones, some of the companies that we've been involved in, I mean, they've created products that can help people with schizophrenia, help people with alcoholism, help people with diabetes.
What's an example of an application of your discovery to treatment of alcoholism?
So the very first company that I got involved starting was a company called Enzatec. And what we did was make little this came out from our early discoveries that we could make microspheres that could release molecules of any size. We merged that company with our downstairs neighbor, Alchemies. And basically that company has created a microsphere that can deliver a drug for a month. It's been shown to greatly reduce alcoholism.
So a microsphere being a polymer that releases a chemical that inhibits the desire to drink alcohol?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a little microsphere that you can inject through a small needle once a month. And does just what you said. You can also use that same microsphere to, reduce people's reliance on cocaine or narcotics as well.
We've talked a lot about polymers and controlled drug delivery to things like tumors. You've also spent a good portion of your career on tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Can you describe what that is briefly?
Sure. Well, lots of times people have serious medical problems where they don't have, their liver's gone bad or they're burned or all kinds of problems where they don't have a tissue or an organ or it's been seriously damaged. So around 1983, a friend of mine, Jay Vacanti, he's head of pediatric surgery at Mass General, he came to talk to me about this. At that time, he was head of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital. And we started talking about ways that we might be able to use plastics and cells, mammalian cells, to craft new tissues and organs. And that would eventually lead to new strategies for creating artificial skin for burn victims, new ways of creating, well, livers or, intestines. A lot of them are at the research stage. We're also looking at ways of making new spinal cords for people that are paralyzed, vocal cords for people that have difficulty speaking or singing. So all kinds of things like that.
So what is the tissue made of?
Well, the strategy that we use is you have a polymer plastic scaffold, and then you put the cells on it. And over time, the cells make what's called their own extracellular matrix. So all the same proteins, hopefully, and sugars and other things that are in the human body, to begin with, the cells recreate. Hmm. And over time, that plastic scaffold dissolves. It's a dissolvable scaffold that we've designed. So in essence, rather than ladies' girdles or other things, what you're having is what the body normally would have, which are what are called these extracellular matrix proteins and polysaccharides.
So the plastic delivers, it's sort of a platter for this artificial tissue, which flirts with or fractionizes with the real tissue in the body, and they cohere and intermingle and then become their own organism.
Yeah, I think that you said it pretty well.
Hmm.
Yeah. Each tissue has its own challenges, but that's sort of the general strategy that we've developed.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder and chief researcher of the Langer Labs at MIT. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed the discoveries originated in his labs. Dr. Langer is a magician. I'd like to turn to your personal life.
Sure.
Tell me about this magic.
Well, I've always been fascinated by magic. So from time to time, I try to learn how to do tricks. I mean, I remember taking even a magic class and, I would always love going to magic shops and seeing people do tricks. And I used to do shows when my kids were little. And I remember one time even doing a show at MIT for 400 people. That was a while ago. I'm probably pretty rusty now.
Is there an area of magic that you prefer? Do you like the cards or the body disappearance or what?
Yeah, well, actually, I like the cards. People have often broken up magic into two kinds of magic, stage magic and close-up magic. Stage magic is like the body disappearing and things like that. But I've always liked the sort of close-up magic with cards or coins, but particularly cards. I've always thought those were fascinating.
In a way, magic and chemistry or science seem on the face of it very similar. You have something that, you know, on the surface is wow-generating. And your job and your hobby is to understand how to create that wow. Your job is to understand the reasons for that outcome.
I mean, some things could even, you know, appear like magic. Like we just published a paper a week or two ago in Science where some of my postdocs found like this this plastic or polymer that can, you put it on your hand and it starts jumping all over the place. And it can even lift things. That's almost magical. And a lot of what we've ended up doing in the lab is understanding better phenomena that is extremely complicated.
How long have you been interested in magic?
Oh, I've been, you know, many, many years since I was a little boy.
You grew up in Albany, New York. What did your parents do?
Well, my dad ran a small liquor store, and my mom was a homemaker. Took care of me and my sister.
What was your home life like?
It was great. I mean, you know, we lived on a small street in Albany. You know, I had a lot of friends. I remember playing baseball and football and things like that. And I went to the local public school, 27. It was nice.
You're an inventor, essentially. At what point did you think, you know, I'd like to be an inventor or some type of creator or engineer in your childhood? Were those seeds apparent to you that early?
They weren't apparent to me that early. But one of the things that I had that I got as gifts, there was a company called Gilbert when I was a little boy. And they made all kinds of great things that kids like to play with. I mean, they had this Erector set, and they had a whole bunch of different ones of various complexity, you know, where you could build structures like a merry-go-round, another where there was like a parachute jump, another where you could launch rockets. And then they also had a microscope set, and they had a chemistry set. And so I really enjoyed that kind of stuff when I was a little boy. And even like with the chemistry set, I remember mixing different chemicals together and watching the solutions change color, which is magic. But also, it was a chemical reaction going on that caused that. But I never thought about inventing it. I just thought it was fun.
Would you say that you fell into what you're doing accidentally, or was it more mindful?
Well, I think it's somewhat accidental. I mean, you know, I certainly had no grand plan ever. I think the big thing that changed it for me in terms of what I ended up doing was what my postdoctoral work after I graduated from MIT, when I went to work for Judah Folkman. And I was like probably one of the few chemical engineers in the world, maybe the only one working in a surgery lab. And I started thinking about applying chemical engineering to medicine. And that certainly changed my life.
Dr. Folkman compared research to driving at night. Can you describe that analogy?
Yes, that's very good. Dr. Folkman said, trying to solve the problem of angiogenesis or some of the other things would be kind of like driving at night. You can't see past where the headlights go, but you can do the whole trip that way. So in other words, you don't know the answer when you're starting, but you could make steps, and those steps would eventually get you there.
What are some images that come to your mind when you think of your research? You know, when is this driving at night? What about like crystallization? You know, how they have a formation of a crystal and it becomes like this whole network of crystals.
Right, right.
But like that's my own.
Sorry. Rock candy. That's significant. I mean, that's an example. I mean, certainly one thing that actually we were involved in. In fact, we started a company on that too, was a company called Transform, where one of the challenges actually when you make pharmaceuticals is having a good shelf life. Because you don't want to use a drug. If the drug, after you make it, is unstable after a month, nobody's going to use it. You're going to ship it all over the world. You need it, and a lot of times you won't use a drug for a year or two. So getting the drug in the right crystal form that's in the right stability, that actually is a big deal. If you don't get it in the right crystal form, it may not be stable, and then it won't be useful to anybody.
Hmm.
But if it is in the right crystal form, it can be very stable.
You exercise daily. How long have you been exercising, and why is it so important to you?
Well, I've probably been exercising probably for a lot, probably the last 32 years, 33 years. It's important. Well, my dad died of a heart attack when he was 61, and, you know, I was 28 at the time. I mean, so I just, you know, want to live as long as I can for my kids and my wife and my family. And
what kind of what do you do for exercise?
Well, I use a recumbent bike, elliptical machine, treadmill, and weights.
For how long?
Probably 2 to 3 hours a day.
So 2 to 3 hours, that seems above average.
I think it's probably quite a bit above average, certainly for somebody my age. But I'm able to work while I do it, and my wife and kids actually exercise a lot. And, you know, we have this gym at home, so sometimes we're all doing it together, or at least a few of us. And so, it is certainly above average.
Hmm. You mentioned your wife. You met your wife at MIT. She's a neuroscientist. How did you meet?
We met on the track. I was running actually outside, and so was she. I knew her, though, a little bit because one of the people in our lab was roommates with her, so I knew her a little bit. But then I saw her on the track, and we started talking, and so that's how that happened.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer. Coming up, we'll meet Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, a software company focused on energy efficiency. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. Students from more than 60 colleges, including Stanford, Boston University, Georgetown, Emory, and Barnard, have teamed up with preschool children in the most at-risk neighborhoods with the hopes of tackling America's literacy problem. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Where did the idea for Jumpstart come from initially?
So the original group of founders from Jumpstart worked at a place called Ramapo for Children. This is a residential summer camp in Rhinebeck, New York, which is unique in that it's got a one-to-one staff-to-camper ratio. The staff are college students who come to work incredibly hard with mostly inner-city children with a wide range of behavioral learning and emotional problems.
Then how did you then take that idea and say, okay, we want to expand this nationally?
We really struggled with the idea of how do you get this same type of individualized attention for low-income populations in the communities in which the children lived, but really be able to do it anywhere, not just as a residential summer camp, and really focus on language and literacy development. My co-founder was at Yale, Aaron Lieberman, and we started talking with Ed Ziegler, who was one of the national founders of Head Start under the Johnson administration. And he was very bullish on the idea and thought that if we started training and selecting college students to work with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds in low-income communities, that we could really have a demonstrable gain in school readiness skills for this population.
We take for granted that the foundation for success is established before kindergarten, and you have organizations like the Harlem Children's Zone run by Jeffrey Canada and Jumpstart, which was co-founded by you, addressing that assumption. Where did that come from? Why have we developed that assumption or fact now that the pre-kindergarten years are the most essential years?
It's a lot of studies that have been done that show that 80% of your IQ is determined by the time that you're 5 years old, that the most important skill for children to have in school is a basic literacy by the time you're in third grade. And there's a huge difference between low-income preschool populations versus their middle and upper income peers. And we figured if we can intervene at the earliest possible moment, that we could close this achievement gap between these two different populations. And that was really the need that we saw that we wanted to address with Jumpstart.
So your co-founder, Aaron Lieberman, is a student at Yale and you're a student at Harvard. How did you go about logistically making it happen?
Well, to be fair, there was a somewhat of a wider founding group, including a great woman named Rebecca Weintraub, a great guy named Jordan Moranis. The way we started is by sitting in our college dining halls and saying, hey, would you like to read with a preschool child today? We teamed up with a great preschool center called Jamaica Plain Head Start. And pretty early on when we started connecting college students with children at Jamaica Plain Head Start, we saw the same types of things that we had seen when we were bunk counselors at Ramapo Anchorage Camp happen in this preschool center in a very poor area of Boston. And that was children who came to us who didn't even know how to hold on to a book. Mm-hmm. Over the course of not months, but even just weeks, could sit down quietly with their Jumpstart core member, who was the college student from Harvard at that time, and start reading books like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, start doing activities to bring those books alive, and really take an interest in literacy from the age of three.
We talk about Jumpstart having a focus on literacy, but these children coming from these low-income communities, you know, often have emotional neglect and other psychological issues because they don't have the support coming from, you know, very functional parents all the time. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you dealt with those issues and what those were?
Sure. Our belief was we weren't going to take a professional mental health approach to this. None of our college students that we recruited and trained had that background. But we did think that if you get a highly enthusiastic and well-trained college student to work with a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old, that they would blossom not just because they started to take an interest in books, but because they had somebody who they felt like really cared for them. And they had a fantastic role model for somebody that they might become.
What were some of the frustrations that you faced?
I think that the one-on-one connection generally worked. It's a matchmaking process. There were certainly times where a core member would come for a Jumpstart session and the child simply would not want to be with them. They were scared. They didn't warm up to that core member for sometimes several days and even weeks. We never really had a situation where eventually the breakthrough didn't happen, but it could often take time.
And how many students were you focusing on in Boston in the first year or two?
So the first year when I was still in college, busy writing a senior thesis and taking college courses, we had 15 college students working with 15 preschool children. We built that up over time, so we basically doubled every year. And then when we were able to do this full time, thanks to something called an Echoing Green Fellowship for public service entrepreneurs, we could really build that growth rate even more.
Incidentally, you mentioned Echoing Green. They're an organization that supports social entrepreneurs by providing them with some financing, among other things.
Yeah, financing definitely, but also they bring them together for a seminar on how do you create something from scratch. It was partially the technical assistance that they gave us, how you apply for your 501c3 status, how you do the bookkeeping and raise money and other things. But really, it was the example that they showed, the fact that we were in a support network of other social entrepreneurs, many of whom were in Boston, and that we could really reach out to. Because being an entrepreneur is incredibly exciting and it can be fairly lonely as well. A lot of my classmates who were at investment banks or at consulting firms while they didn't have the excitement of starting something on their own, they did have a structure and support network that we just didn't have. We were on a high wire without a net underneath.
So talk to me about the process of going from one or two colleges, and at the time it was Harvard and Yale students participating in this, to now more than 60. How did you think about that?
There was definitely a huge amount of tension in both the early days and as we started to grow more rapidly between the idea that you should really start very slowly, perfect the model, and then try to roll it out over time versus those who felt like we could build the airplane while flying it. I remember when I did my thesis, senior thesis at Harvard, there was the idea between the hold and harvest, which is the go slow approach, versus the fixes fail, which is grow and you'll figure out as you're doing it. My own feeling is that you have to build the aircraft while you're flying it, that with scale comes opportunity, and you have to get to that scale even if you haven't figured out every detail of the program. We also tried to involve some real thought leaders in the space. So there was a guy named Jeff Braddock, who was a professor at Harvard Business School. He had spent most of his time thinking about how for-profit franchisees grow, bagel stores and donut shops. But he really used his brain power along with a board that we developed to think about how do we bring this nationally. And really the best way for us to do that was to reach out to colleges and universities to let them know about Jumpstart, but that they would actually apply to Jumpstart and we would help them start on their campus.
How did you support yourself in the early days?
I lived with some dear friends in an old haunted house in Somerville, Massachusetts, where I was paying $300 a month in rent. And that actually seemed like pretty decent living to me. When I first became an Echoing Green Fellow and Aaron and I launched this, we were both making $15,000 a year. And we begged a real estate developer named Danny Levin to give us donated office space, which he did. It was a small three-room office that had tons of mice running around, so we never felt like we were alone. And we sort of begged and scraped our way into forming this organization. We wanted there to be some sort of brand recognition of Jumpstart at some point. So we designed our own logo, which is very similar to the logo that Jumpstart still uses today, two circles with hands holding a book to show the one-on-one interaction around reading. And we called around to find the cheapest place that we could get T-shirts printed. We ended up with a place in Waltham, Massachusetts called Just Say Rock. And I remember going out there to pick up the T-shirts because, God forbid, we should pay a delivery fee. And we were the only T-shirt that was not a black T-shirt with a Megadeth logo on the front of it at this particular T-shirt place. So those early days certainly lead to some interesting experiences.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. David co-founded Jumpstart while he was a student at Harvard College, and he's gone on to work in various fields of finance and stem cell research. In 1999, you had a personal setback. It was between Jumpstart and Stanford Business School where you had an accident that left you paralyzed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
After I'd gotten into Stanford Business School, I was traveling in Latin America and was paralyzed in a diving accident. And it really, it was definitely the first time where I'd felt like I'd had a significant obstacle in my path. And although my parents had been divorced when I was in high school, I really led a pretty blessed existence. But this was definitely having to learn how to live life in a new body. And that takes its own sense of entrepreneurship to figure out how to take care of your daily activities in a new situation. I was had to use a wheelchair. I had no movement or sensation below my chest, and only partial use of my hands.
Here you have this series of successes with Jumpstart going well. You get into Stanford Business School, and then you have this big setback in 1999. Do you feel like you perhaps weren't able to handle it as well because you had been used to a charmed life to some extent? Like, how do you reconcile that?
I think a lot of the response to paralysis is based just strictly on personality, and I guess I have a good thing going because I'm pretty darn stubborn. And I happen to just have a very optimistic view on life. And so the process of adjusting, while not easy at all, was something that I was fairly well prepared for. On the other hand, you know, the feelings of loss and of frustration were definitely new to me. And dealing with those and trying to incorporate that into my life and to feel like I could move on even when so many of the things that had been so simple before now were so difficult is something that I had to adjust to, and frankly, I still have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And how did it impact the decisions that you made, whether it be personal or professional, if at all?
I think the biggest one for me professionally, I was lucky. I wasn't a lumberjack or a dancer, something that was my career had to change because of my physical situation. I felt like I could still be an entrepreneur. I definitely got a lot more interested in the healthcare field, something that I spent a lot of time on when I was at Stanford Business School, when I was working in the Treasury Department under Secretary Paul O'Neill, and that I decided to do when I got part of the when I was part of the Prop 71 campaign. The Prop 71 campaign was really a grassroots movement from the patient advocacy community, started by a really visionary guy named Bob Klein, who had a son with type 1 diabetes. And between other parents of kids with type 1 diabetes, people like Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve, we created a coalition of people who could really advocate for an alternative national program in stem cell research. It just happened to be located in the state of California, where you can take advantage of the unique brand of democracy where 600,000 signatures gets anything you want on the ballot. So we had taken the restrictions that had been put on in the Bush administration on federal funding and created an opportunity in the state of California to push research ahead in this very vital field.
Is there any sense that stem cell research could help your ailment?
There are definitely people who feel like one day it may have applicability towards spinal cord injury. That wasn't my personal motivation. I sort of come to be comfortable in life in a wheelchair and feel like I'm pretty lucky given where I am. My situation is stable, and I'm not like, unfortunately, many others who are dealing with a disease or condition in which it's really degenerative. Mm-hmm. So I really thought of it for future patients, people who might not have to live through this, a lot of the same circumstances that I have, or different diseases, rather than my own situation.
You are married now. You have twins.
Yes, I do.
And you've moved on to now the field of asset management and finance. What role does Jumpstart play in your life now?
Jumpstart plays still a huge role in my life. You know, professionally, I've now started a new organization. And the experience of having started Jumpstart, even though I'm in a very different field, feels very familiar. The early days of trying to form a team, make clear vision, and to execute on that, is very similar from those early days of being in my dorm room. On the family front, I now have twins, a boy and a girl, who are starting to learn to read. And that is so exciting for me because we spend probably an hour a day, whether it's 5 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the evening, where I get to spend time going through books with them. And that is just one of the great pleasures in my life. And I hear my daughter, when she does wake us up at 5 o'clock in the morning, saying, "Polar bear, polar bear, what do you hear?" In our bed while we're trying to getting her back to sleep.
David, thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.